Chapter 3 Sales. Every successful business ultimately sells what it has to offer. Having millions of prospects isn't enough if no one ultimately pulls out their wallet and says, "I'll take one." The sales process begins with a prospect and ends with a paying customer. No sale, no business. The best businesses in the world earn the trust of their prospects and help them understand why the offer is worth paying for. No one wants to make a bad decision or be taken advantage of, so sales mostly consists of helping the prospect understand what's important and convincing them you're capable of actually delivering on what you promise. The end of the sales process is an excited new customer and more cash in the bank. Transaction. A transaction is an exchange of value between two or more parties. If I have something you want and you have something I want, we'd be both better off if we agreed to trade. The transaction is the defining moment of every business. Sales are the only point in the business cycle where resources flow into the business, which makes completing transactions critically important. Businesses survive by bringing in more money than they spend, and there's no way to do that without completing transactions. You can only transact with things that are economically valuable. If you don't have anything your prospective customers want, they won't buy from you. This may seem obvious, but it's amazing how many prospective business people enter a market without something the market wants. That's why developing and testing a minimum viable offer is so important. It's the best way to determine whether or not you've created something valuable enough to sell before you invest your life savings. When you're starting a new business, the object is to get to the point where you make your first profitable transaction as quickly as you possibly can, because that's the point where you transition from being a project to being a business. The examples and concepts in this chapter will help you create profitable transactions that both parties are happy with. Trust. Here's a proposal. Send me a certified bank check for $100,000 right now, and in 10 years, I'll give you the keys to a brand new 10,000 square foot villa on Italy's Amalfi Coast. You can't see any example villas, you won't hear from me again until the villa is ready, and there are absolutely no refunds. Do we have a deal? Unless you are an extremely trusting soul with cash to burn, probably not. After all, how can you be sure I can actually build you a seaside mansion for such a paltry sum? How can you be sure I won't just take the money and disappear? You can't, which is why you shouldn't cut me, or anyone else, a check for a villa on the Mediterranean you've never seen. Let's reverse the situation. Let's assume I'm capable of building this villa, and you're interested in purchasing one. Would it be smart for me to purchase land, break ground, and start building before I'm sure you actually have the money to pay for it? Probably not. If the deal falls through, I'd have to find another customer or eat the cost. Without a certain amount of trust between parties, a transaction will not take place. No matter what promises are made or how good the deal sounds, no customer is going to be willing to part with their hard-earned money unless they believe you're capable of delivering what you promise. Likewise, it's usually not smart to accept credit or IOUs from customers you don't know. Building a trustworthy reputation over time by dealing fairly and honestly is the best way to build trust. You can also take steps to signal you're trustworthy. Organizations like the Better Business Bureau, credit and background check services, and financial arrangements like escrow accounts exist to help overcome an initial lack of trust between parties in a transaction. These offerings break down an important mutual barrier to completing a sale. Without these services, many transactions would never take place. The easier it is to demonstrate your trustworthiness and verify that the other party is trustworthy, the greater the chance of a successful transaction. Common ground. Common ground is a state of overlapping interests between two or more parties. Think of your available options as a circle that surrounds you. Your prospects have a circle of available options as well. Your job is to find exactly where those circles overlap, which is much easier if you understand what your probable purchasers want or need. Consider the job you're currently in, or the last one you held. Chances are, you accepted that job because you were willing to take on certain responsibilities, and your employer was interested in having you do the work. You were interested in being paid a certain amount, and your employer was willing to pay you at least that much. Your interests overlapped, which resulted in a job offer and a paid position at the company. That's common ground. The same thing happens every time you purchase something from a retailer. They have a product you want to own. You have a certain amount of money they are willing to accept for the product. If you don't want the product or the retailer wants more than you're willing to pay, no transaction will take place. Common ground is a precondition of any type of transaction. Without any areas of overlapping interest, there's no reason for a prospect to choose to work with you. After all, it wouldn't make sense to pay more for something than it's worth to you. Why expect your prospects to accept your offer if it's not in their best interest? Aligning interests is critical to finding common ground. Sales isn't about convincing somebody to do something that is not in their best interest. Ideally, you should want exactly what your prospects want, the satisfaction of their desire or the resolution of their problem. The more your interests are aligned with your prospects, the more they'll trust your ability to give them what they want. There are always many paths to a successful transaction, which is the essence of negotiation. Negotiation is the process of exploring different options to find common ground. The more potential paths you explore, the greater the chance you'll be able to find one in which your interests overlap. The more open you are to potential options, the higher the likelihood you'll find an area of common ground that's acceptable for all parties involved. The pricing uncertainty principle. One of the most fascinating parts of sales is what I call the pricing uncertainty principle. All prices are arbitrary and malleable. Pricing is always an executive decision. If you want to try to sell a small rock for $350 million, you can. If you want to quadruple that price or reduce it to 10 cents an hour later, there's absolutely nothing stopping you. Any price can be set to any level, any time, without limitation. The pricing uncertainty principle has an important corollary. You must be able to support your asking price before a customer will actually accept it. In general, people prefer to pay as little as possible to acquire the things they want, with some notable exceptions, which we'll discuss later in social signaling. If you expect people to pay you perfectly good money to buy what you're offering, you must be able to provide a reason why the offered price is worth paying. It's difficult to support a price of $350 million for a rock, unless that rock is the Hope Diamond, a 45.5-carat deep blue diamond with a long and distinguished history. The Hope Diamond is currently owned by the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and is not for sale. If the Smithsonian decided to sell the Hope Diamond, however, they could easily set an asking price of $1 billion. What's to stop them? Auctions are an example of the pricing uncertainty principle at work. Prices change constantly, rising in proportion to how many people are interested and how much they're each willing to spend. By setting a low starting price and allowing potential buyers to bid against one another, auctions are typically an efficient way to establish a true market price for something that is difficult to reproduce and where no comparable items are already in the market. That's why rare items like the Hope Diamond, if they're sold, are typically sold at auction. The most expensive diamond ever sold was the rough 507.5-carat Cullinan Heritage Diamond, which went for $35.3 million at auction. Not bad for a rock. Four pricing methods. Let's assume for a moment you own a house you're willing to sell. The pricing uncertainty principle says the price could be anything. You have to set it yourself, since houses don't come with built-in price tags. Let's also assume you'd prefer to sell the house for as much as possible. How would you go about setting the largest price a customer will actually accept? There are four ways to support a price on something of value. Number one, replacement cost. Number two, market comparison. Number three, the discounted cash flow or net present value method. And number four, value comparison. These four pricing methods will help you estimate just how much something is potentially worth to your customers. The replacement cost method supports a price by answering the question, how much would it cost to replace? In the case of the house, the question becomes, what would it cost to create or construct a house just like this one? Assume a meteorite scored a direct hit on the house and there's nothing left. You have to rebuild the house from scratch. What would it take to purchase similar land, pay for an architect to draw up plans, acquire identical materials, and hire construction workers to create exactly the same house. Total up these costs, add a bit of margin to compensate for your time and effort, and you'll have a supportable estimate of how much your house is worth. Applied to most offers, replacement cost is typically a cost-plus calculation. Figure out how much it costs to create, add your desired markup, and set your price appropriately. The market comparison method supports a price by answering the question, how much are other things like this selling for? In the case of the house, this question becomes, how much have houses like this in this general area sold for recently? If you look at the surrounding area, there are probably a few other houses similar to the one you own that have sold within the past year. They're probably not exactly the same. Maybe they have an extra bedroom or bathroom, a little less square footage, etc. But they're close enough. After you adjust for the differences, you can use the sale price of those comparable houses to create a supportable estimate of how much your house is worth. Market comparison is a very common way to price offers. Find a similar offer and set your price relatively close to what they're asking. The discounted cash flow or net present value method supports a price by answering the question, how much is it worth if it can bring in money over time? In the case of your house, the question becomes, how much would this house bring in each month if you rented it for a period of time, and how much is that series of cash flows worth as a lump sum today? Rent payments come in every month, which is quite handy. You can use discounted cash flow and net present value formulas to calculate what that series of payments over a certain period of time would be worth if you received it in one lump sum. By calculating the net present value of the house, assuming you could rent it for $2,000 a month for a period of 10 years with 95% occupancy, and you could earn 7% interest on your money by choosing the next best alternative, you'll have a supportable estimate of what the house is worth. The discounted cash flow and net present value method is only used for pricing things that can produce an ongoing cash flow, which makes it a very common way to price businesses when they're sold or acquired. The more profit the business generates each month, the more valuable the business is to the purchaser. The value comparison method supports a price by answering the question, who is this particularly valuable to? In the case of the house, this question becomes, what features of this house would make it valuable to certain types of people? Let's assume the house is in an attractive, safe neighborhood with a top-tier public school nearby. These characteristics would make the house more valuable to families who have school-aged children, particularly if they want to attend that school. To potential home buyers in the market, this particular house would be more valuable than the same house in an area with inferior schools. Here's another example. Assume Elvis Presley previously owned the house. To certain types of people, wealthy people who love Elvis, this house would be extremely valuable. Elvis's previous involvement with the property could easily triple or quadruple the price you'd be able to support via the replacement, market comparison, or discounted cash flow net present value methods. By looking at the unique characteristics of what you're offering and the corresponding worth of those characteristics to certain individuals, you can often support much higher prices. Value comparison is typically the optimal way to price your offer, since the value of an offer to a specific group can be quite high, resulting in a much better price. Use the other methods as a baseline, but focus on discovering how much your offer is worth to the party you hope to sell it to, then set your price accordingly. Price transition shock. When you change the price of an offer, the effects aren't limited to your current target market. A change in prices can change your typical prospect overnight. Most people who are new to business assume that the best way to increase sales is to reduce prices. That's not necessarily true. Often, raising your prices is an effective way to attract more customers. Discounts attract customers when the offer is a commodity. If there's no difference between the gasoline at one gas station and another, the station that reduces its gas prices may bring in more customers. Since most service stations make more money from their convenience stores than they make selling gasoline, a gas discounting strategy may lead to higher profits. In introductory economics courses, this idea is called price elasticity. Offers with high price elasticity experience major changes in demand when prices go up or down, Offers with low price elasticity experience little fluctuation in demand when prices change. Economists love to draw downward sloping pricing curves that show demand increasing as prices decrease. The trouble with the traditional pricing curve is that it can be misleading when the offer isn't a commodity. In practice, raising your prices can increase demand by appealing to a more attractive type of customer. Automobiles are a classic example of this type of price sensitivity. Some cars are desirable because they're expensive. The typical customer who purchases a Bentley Continental GT is very different from the type of customer who purchases a Toyota Camry. As you test different pricing strategies, you'll notice certain thresholds where you stop appealing to certain types of customers and start appealing to customers with very different characteristics. This price transition shock can completely change the experience of operating your business, and you shouldn't take it lightly. There are two major considerations when setting your prices with price transition shock in mind. Number one, potential profitability, and number two, ideal customer characteristics. The best strategy is to set your prices to appeal to the prospects that will ensure you work with your most desirable customers in a way that results in the highest profits. The ideal balance depends on your target market. In some markets, it's easy to serve customers who are attracted to low prices. In others, discount customers can be challenging and rude. Likewise, prospects that don't blink at high prices can be pleasant and cordial, or demanding and snooty. The experience depends on the industry and the prospect's expectations. One of the businesses I've been involved with over the years succeeded in doubling its average order value by eliminating low-priced offers. As a result, profits increased. As a second-order effect, which we'll discuss later, the company's typical customer changed for the worse. Prospects made unreasonable demands more often and acted in disrespectful ways when those demands weren't met. The short-term financial result was positive, but the change placed extraordinary stress on the staff. On the other hand, a service business I advise decided to quadruple its typical service price and found that its new positioning appealed to its ideal customers, people who valued the firm's work and took the project seriously. Non-ideal customers were turned off by the hike in prices, so they went away. As a result, the company filled its client roster with excellent customers and increased profits by more than 500%. The staff is thrilled with the change. They're doing more work for better clients and getting paid more for their expertise. As you change your prices, the prospects attracted to your offer will also change. So long as you maintain profit sufficiency, which we'll discuss later, you can choose to appeal to any type of customer you please. Value-based selling. Imagine that you provide an ongoing service to a Fortune 500 corporation that increases their annual revenues by $100 million. Is your service worth $10 million a year? Sure. After all, what company would give up $90 million in ongoing revenue? Does it matter if providing this valuable service doesn't cost you much money? Absolutely not. Even if it only costs you $100 a year to provide the service, you're providing a huge amount of value, which supports the comparatively higher price. Does it matter if most business-to-business services cost $10,000 or less? Absolutely not. You're providing much more value than other services in the market, which completely justifies the higher price. Value-based selling is the process of understanding and reinforcing the reasons why your offer is valuable to the purchaser. In the previous section, we discussed how the value comparison method is often the best way to support a high price on your offer. Value-based selling is how you support that price. By understanding and reinforcing the reason why a transaction will be valuable to the customer, you simultaneously increase the likelihood of a transaction as well as the price the buyer will be willing to pay. Value-based selling is not about talking. It's about listening. When most people think of sales, they imagine a pushy, smooth-talking shyster whose sole priority is to close the deal. Emulating shady used car dealers is the fastest way to destroy trust and give your potential customers the impression that you care more about your bottom line than what they want. In reality, the best salespeople are the ones who can listen intently for the things the customer really wants. Asking good questions is the best way to identify what your offer is worth to your prospect. In the classic sales book, Spin Selling, Neil Rackham describes the four phases of successful selling. Number one, understanding the situation. Number two, defining the problem. Number three, clarifying the short-term and long-term implications of that problem. And number four, quantifying the need payoff, or the financial and emotional benefits the customer would experience after the resolution of their problem. Instead of barging in with a premature boilerplate hard sell, successful salespeople focus on asking detailed questions to get to the root of what the prospect really wants. By encouraging your prospects to tell you more about what they need, you reap two major benefits. First, you increase the prospect's confidence in your understanding of the situation, increasing their confidence in your ability to deliver a solution. Second, you'll discover information that will help you emphasize just how valuable your offer is, which helps you in framing the price of your offer versus the value it will provide. If you discover why, how, and how much your offer will benefit the customer, you'll be able to explain that value in terms they'll understand and appreciate. Understanding the value you can provide your customers is the golden path to a profitable sale. Education-based selling. Before moving to Colorado, my wife Kelsey was the sales manager of the Mark Ingram Bridal Atelier in New York City, the most prestigious bridal salon in the world. Her job was to help brides from around the world find the one, the perfect dress for their dream wedding. Mark Ingram is the Martha Stewart of the bridal industry. His sense of style is legendary. Gowns by Oscar de la Renta, Monique Louillet, Lila Rose, and Vera Wang populate his collection. Mark's consultants are so skilled that one of the first three gowns they present is almost always the gown the bride chooses for her wedding. In addition, the shopping experience and customer service are superb. Mark doesn't discount, but brides would rather work with him than purchase their gown from a competitor, even though it would be less expensive. Compared with most bridal salons, the Mark Ingram Bridal Atelier sells very high-end gowns. The average sale price of a gown at Mark's Atelier is $6,000, four times the national average. To make the sale, Mark's consultants must help the bride and her parents, who often pay the bill, understand why the gown is worth the price. It's certainly possible to purchase a less expensive gown from another salon, but cheaper gowns cut corners. They use lower quality fabrics, skimp on construction, and use machined lace or beading. Also, alterations are necessary to ensure that the gown fits the bride perfectly. Mark's team of bridal seamstresses is the best in the world, and you can only work with them if you purchase a gown from Mark's Atelier. If you care about these things, and most fashion-conscious brides certainly do, it's easy to see why it's worth it to purchase a gown from Mark if you can afford to. Education-based selling is the process of making your prospects better, more informed customers. As a sales consultant, Kelsey worked to do two things. Number one, make the bride feel comfortable and relaxed. Then, number two, help the bride become more knowledgeable about gowns in terms of how they're made and what to look for when buying one. Instead of pressuring the bride to close the sale, Kelsey always took the time to explain the ins and outs of fabric, lace, beading, construction, and alterations to the bride and her family. She invested time in making her brides more knowledgeable, and this made them more likely to purchase an expensive dress from her, both because they had learned to fully appreciate the quality of what she was selling, and because she had earned their trust. Education-based selling requires an upfront investment in your prospects, but it's worth it. By investing energy in making your prospects smarter, you simultaneously build trust in your expertise and make them better customers. Be forewarned, however, that effective education requires your offer to be superior in some way to your competitors. Otherwise, you'll be sending customers away. All the more reason to ensure that you have an offer worth selling. Next best alternative. When negotiating, it's always useful to know what the other party is likely to do in the event that an agreement can't be reached. Sometimes it's just not possible to reach an agreement. There's no common ground, so both parties agreed to go their separate ways. What then? Your next best alternative is what you'll do in the event you can't find common ground with the party you're negotiating with. Imagine you're looking for a job, and there are three companies interested in hiring you. You may prefer to work at company A, but if you can't reach a mutually acceptable agreement, it's easier to be a confident negotiator if you know that companies B and C are also interested in hiring you. If company A is your only option and they know it, you're not likely to get a good deal. The other party always has a next best alternative as well. That's what you're negotiating against. If you're selling a product that costs $100, you are selling against the next best thing they could do with that $100, saving, investing, or purchasing something else. If you're trying to hire an employee, you're competing against the next best offer they have from another company. The more options the other party has, the weaker your negotiating position. Understanding the other party's next best alternative gives you a major sales advantage. You can structure your agreement so that it's more attractive than their next best option. The more you know about the other party's alternatives, the more attractively you can frame your total offer by bundling and unbundling various options. Having a strong next best alternative keeps negotiations moving quickly. Many professional sports players who are approaching free agency use the opportunity to renegotiate or renew their contracts with their current teams, particularly if other teams express interest in them. If the original team doesn't want to lose the player, they have an incentive to reach an acceptable deal quickly. In every negotiation, the power lies with the party that is able and willing to walk away from a bad deal. In almost every case, the more acceptable alternatives you have, the better your position. The more attractive your alternatives, the more willing you'll be to walk away from a deal that doesn't serve you, resulting in better deals. Exclusivity. In most sales situations, it's in your best interest to maintain exclusivity, creating a unique offer or quality that other firms can't match. If you're the only person or company that offers what your prospect wants, you're in a very strong position to negotiate on favorable terms. If you want to purchase an iPhone, you have to buy it through Apple. It is the sole source. You may purchase the product directly or through a retailer. Either way, Apple is paid. So long as you want an iPhone and aren't willing to settle for an alternative, Apple wins. Exclusivity is beneficial for many reasons. Exclusive offers make it much easier to maintain high perceived value since there's no direct competition. Substitutes or alternatives may exist, but if a prospect is set on your specific offer, they'll have to obtain it through you, making it far easier for you to set high prices and maintain healthy profit margins. Exclusivity is easiest to maintain when you've created something new, which means an exclusivity strategy makes the most sense for products and services. Resellers typically find it difficult to establish exclusivity unless they play a role in the product's manufacture, which is why retailers often create private label brands. Costco's famous Kirkland Signature brand is a way of creating exclusivity, as is Trader Joe's strategy of negotiating with manufacturers to create unique products. If you're the exclusive source of what your prospects want, you win. Three universal currencies. In every negotiation, there are three universal currencies: resources, time, and flexibility. Any one of these currencies can be traded for more or less of the others. Resources are tangible items like money, gold, oil, etc. Resources are physical. You can hold them in your hand. If you want to buy some furniture, you can offer money in exchange. If you're selling your car, the purchaser could, with your agreement, give you a bar of gold or a mint first edition issue of Action Comics number 1, which features the first appearance of Superman in print. You're simply trading one resource for another. Time is the second major currency. If you go to work as an hourly employee, you are trading a certain amount of time and effort for a certain amount of resources. You can also trade resources for time. You can offer to pay other people in exchange for their work, which is the essence of employment, contracting, and freelancing. Flexibility is the third universal currency, one that is usually quite underrated. Becoming a salaried employee isn't a straightforward exchange of resources for effort. You're also giving up a certain amount of flexibility. There's an implicit agreement that you won't work on other things when you're supposed to be working for the company, which is a very real opportunity cost. While you're working, you're giving up the flexibility to do something else. It's entirely possible to negotiate for a greater or lesser degree of flexibility by trading off effort or resources. For example, you can decrease your effort and increase your flexibility by working part-time in exchange for fewer resources, reduced salary and benefits. Purchasing a house requires less time if you agree to a 30-year mortgage versus saving up to buy it outright, at the cost of additional resources in the form of interest and dramatically decreased flexibility. It's possible to gain more of any of these desired currencies by finding appropriate trade-offs between one or more of the others. If you'd like additional compensation in the form of a raise or a larger contract, you can give up time or flexibility, like the ability to use what you make for other purposes, as a trade-off. If you'd like a bit more flexibility or time off in your working arrangements, you can negotiate a decrease in salary to compensate. If your employer or client wants you to work more or wants to benefit more from your work, you can ask them for more compensation in return. Keep the three universal currencies in mind when negotiating, and you'll be amazed at the range of potential options you'll be able to present to the other party, making it easier to find an option that works for all parties involved. The three dimensions of negotiation. Most people think of negotiation as sitting down at a table with the other party and presenting offers and counteroffers. But that's the last phase of the process. The two other phases happen well before you ever sit down at the negotiating table. The three dimensions of negotiation are setup, structure, and discussion. As David Lax and James Sabinius discuss in the book 3D Negotiation, each of these phases is critically important. By creating an environment that's conducive to a deal and preparing your strategy in advance, you can dramatically increase the probability of finding a mutually acceptable solution. The first phase of every negotiation is the setup, setting the stage for a satisfying outcome to the negotiation. The more you can stack the odds in your favor before you start negotiating, the better the deal you'll be able to strike. For example, who is involved in the negotiation, and are they open to dealing with you? Who are you negotiating with, and do they know who you are and how you can help them? What are you proposing, and how does that benefit the other party? What's the setting? Will you present your offer in person, by phone, or by some other means? What are all of the environmental factors around the deal? Do recent events make this deal more or less important to the other party? Setup is the negotiation equivalent of guiding structure, which we'll discuss later. The environment surrounding the deal plays a huge role in the eventual outcome, so it pays to ensure that the environment is conducive to getting a good deal before you ever reach the table. By thinking about the setup, you can make sure you're negotiating with the right person, the person who has the power to give you what you want. Research is what gives this dimension of negotiation its power. The more knowledge you gain about your negotiating partner during this phase, the more power you have in the entire negotiation, so do your homework before presenting an offer. The second dimension of negotiation is structure, the terms of the proposal. In this phase, you put together your draft proposal in a way they're likely to appreciate and accept. For example, what exactly will you propose, and how will you frame your proposal to the other party? What are the primary benefits of your proposal to the other party? What's the other party's next best alternative, and how is your proposal better? How will you overcome the other party's objections and barriers to purchase? Are there trade-offs or concessions you're willing to make to reach an agreement? Remember, your goal in creating the proposal is to find common ground, an agreement that both parties will be happy to accept. By thinking through the structure of your proposal in advance, you can prepare a few different options that you believe the other party will want on terms you're willing to accept. If you're expecting the other party to balk at the price, for instance, you can prepare arguments to overcome the objection, lower cost options that provide less value, or alternative offers that would better fit their needs. When the time comes for you to discuss the deal with your negotiating partner, you'll be ready for anything. The third dimension of negotiation is the discussion, actually presenting the offer to the other party. The discussion is where you actually talk through your proposal with the other party. Sometimes the discussion happens the way you see it in the movies, in a mahogany-walled boardroom across the table, toe-to-toe with the CEO. Sometimes it happens over the phone. Sometimes it happens over email. Whatever the setting, this is the point where you present your offer, discuss or clarify any issues the other party doesn't understand, answer objections, remove barriers to purchase, and ask for the sale. Regardless of what happens during the discussion phase, the end result of every round of discussion is either, number one, yes, we have a deal on these terms, number two, we don't have a deal quite yet, here's a counteroffer or another option to consider, or number three, no, we don't have a deal, there's clearly no common ground, so we'll suspend negotiations and reserve the right to talk to somebody else. Discussion continues until a final agreement is reached, or the parties decide to quit negotiating, whichever happens first. If you prepare the three dimensions of negotiation, setup, structure, and discussion, in advance, you'll be far more likely to settle on terms that benefit both parties. Buffer. In all but the most extenuating circumstances, common ground ensures that every deal is in the best interest of all parties involved. However, there may be parts of the agreement or discussion where one party's gain is the other party's loss. If you're interviewing for a job and you attempt to negotiate a higher salary, any increase in your salary is necessarily the employer's loss. Depending on the situation, these aspects of negotiation can be tense. You want to push for as much as you possibly can, but if you push too hard, you risk torpedoing the deal and permanently harming your relationship with the other party. In these cases, it's helpful to work with someone who can help you negotiate a good deal without risking the relationship. A buffer is a third party empowered to negotiate on your behalf. Agents, attorneys, mediators, brokers, accountants, and other similar subject matter experts are all examples of buffers. Buffers who have expertise in specific types of negotiations can be extremely valuable in helping you get the best deal possible. You don't have to know everything about arcane topics like tort law and tax policy if you enlist the help of an honest and capable buffer. When a professional athlete is negotiating a contract to join a professional sports team, he or she typically enlists the help of both an agent and an attorney. The agent's job is to obtain the best possible compensation for the athlete, and the team manager and owner know that. They can remain positive about hiring the athlete even while the agent plays hardball. In the end, the athlete's overall compensation is improved despite the agent's fees. The same thing happens with the athlete's attorney, who can argue for the inclusion or exclusion of certain provisions in the proposed contract. An attorney can make these proposals with much greater force and effect based on their knowledge, experience, and expertise. Together with the agent, the attorney can work with the team owner and manager to ensure that the athlete gets the best deal the team is willing to accept without adversely affecting the athlete's reputation or goodwill. Buffers can be useful in order to add some time or space to a high-intensity negotiation. It's often quite useful not to be the party who has the final say. Being able to say, "I need to discuss this with my agent or accountant or attorney," before giving final approval on a deal is a valuable check step that prevents hasty or unwise decisions. Be very mindful of incentive-caused bias, which we'll discuss later, when working with a buffer. Depending on the arrangement, your buffer's priorities may be very different from your own. For example, real estate agents act as buffers between the sellers of property and potential purchasers. If you're looking to buy property, it's often useful to work with a buy-side agent, provided you're aware of how they're compensated. Agents are typically compensated on a commission basis, so it pays to be wary if you're using them on the buy side of a deal. The agent is compensated if and only if a transaction actually occurs. Accordingly, their first priority is to complete a deal, any deal, regardless of whether or not it's actually a good deal for the buyer. If at all possible, work with a buffer who is willing to accept a flat fee in exchange for services rendered, whether or not the deal happens. If your buffer will be paid regardless of what happens, their interests will be more closely aligned with getting you the best deal possible, which enhances their reputation. Don't let your buffer replace your own informed judgment. One of the worst things you can do is relinquish control over your decisions to your buffer, particularly if your interests aren't exactly aligned. Many unwary investors have found their savings depleted by giving carte blanche control to investment professionals who are compensated every time a security is bought or sold. By churning the account, the broker is legally able to rack up thousands of dollars in unnecessary fees. As a rule of thumb, don't give anyone unfettered control over decisions that directly affect your money. Buffers can be hugely valuable as long as you're clear about how they'll be rewarded, what they're responsible for, and how you intend to work together. Persuasion resistance. One of the things that makes prospects uncomfortable around salespeople is the feeling that they're going to get the hard sell or be tricked into agreeing to something that's not in their best interest. This experience is called persuasion resistance, and it's a major barrier to making sales. When a prospect senses that someone is trying to convince or compel them to do something they're not sure about, they automatically resist and attempt to move away from the conversation. This is particularly true in situations where the salesperson is trying to force a choice or limit the prospect's available options in some way. Psychologists call this reactance, and it appears in early childhood. Every parent has experienced the fallout of telling a child they can't or have to do something. Prospects react in much the same way when a salesperson attempts to pressure a sale, resisting out of an instinct to preserve their autonomy. The harder the salesperson pushes, the more the prospect resists. That's why hard sell approaches usually fail to generate sustainable results. The more effective strategy, in the words of renowned sales expert Zig Ziglar, is to present yourself to the prospect as an assistant buyer. Your job is not to sell the prospect a bill of goods, it's to help them make an informed decision about what's best for them. You're not pressuring them to give you their money. You're helping to ensure they invest their resources wisely. This basic reinterpretation of your role in the sales process works. It eliminates the prospect's feeling of pressure by convincing them you're looking out for their best interests. Salespeople need to be aware of two additional signals that can trigger persuasion resistance: desperation and chasing. Sending either signal during any part of the sales process will reduce the number and size of the transactions you close. If a prospect feels that you're desperate to make a sale, it diminishes their interest in a matter of seconds. Desperation is a subtle signal that other people don't find your offer desirable, and social proof, which we'll discuss later, starts working against you. In the same way that people don't want to date a person who desperately wants to be in a relationship, prospects don't want to do business with a person who desperately wants or needs their money. It's much better to present yourself with confidence in a way that signals your offer is valuable, is a good fit for the prospect, and will be a wise investment of the prospect's money. If you don't genuinely believe that, you need to find something else to sell. If a prospect senses you're chasing them, their first impulse will be to move away from you. Chasing and being chased are evolutionary patterns that our primal minds recognize very quickly. For centuries, human beings have chased things that are desirable, and they have been chased by threats. Even if we wouldn't consciously label a situation as chasing or being chased, our minds notice and respond automatically. Chasing a prospect to make a sale is counterproductive, a waste of time and energy. Instead, find ways to frame the situation in a way that encourages the prospect to feel like they're chasing you. If your prospect feels that they need to justify why they're good enough to work with you, you're in a very strong position to make a sale on favorable terms. We'll discuss additional ways our primal minds process our modern environment in caveman syndrome. For now, it's important to remember that these social signals may seem silly at best or manipulative at worst, but that doesn't make them any less real or important. By understanding how your prospects evaluate offers, you can plan your pitch in a way that minimizes persuasion resistance and encourages the prospect to desire what you have to offer. If you're interested in exploring these signals in more detail, I recommend reading Pitch Anything by Oren Claff. Reciprocation. Reciprocation is the strong desire most people feel to pay back favors, gifts, benefits, and resources provided. If you've ever had the experience of receiving a holiday gift from someone you didn't send anything to, you know how uncomfortable this feels. If someone benefits us, we like to benefit them in return. As a social force, reciprocation is one of the primary psychological tendencies that underlie human cooperation. The "you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours" instinct is extremely powerful and forms the foundation of friendships and alliances. Historically, gift-giving was how the powerful remained in power. By throwing lavish parties or generously awarding titles and land, leaders increased their influence by amassing a store of favors that could be called on in times of need. Here's the tricky part. The desire to reciprocate is not necessarily in proportion to the original benefit provided. In the book Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion, Robert Cialdini provides an example of reciprocation in car sales. Car salesmen typically offer prospects a small gift up front. Can I get you a coffee? Would you like a soda? Some water? Cookies? Is there anything I can do to make you more comfortable? It seems like a common gesture of hospitality. It's not. Accepting this small offer creates a psychological need to reciprocate, subtly stacking the deck in the salesman's favor. Prospective car buyers who accepted this free offer were far more likely to purchase a vehicle, add optional accessories, and agree to less attractive financing terms. As a result, these customers spent thousands of dollars more than the people who did not accept anything from the salesman while negotiating. That doesn't make rational sense, because the coffee or cookies cost the dealer very little, but reciprocation makes it more likely that the buyer will pay back the favor with a much larger concession. The more legitimate value you can provide to others up front, the more receptive they'll be when it's time for your pitch. Providing free value builds your social capital, making it more likely the people you benefit will reciprocate when you make an offer down the road. Being generous is one of the best things you can do to improve your results as a salesperson. By giving away value and helping others as much as you can, they'll respect you. It will build your reputation, and it will also increase the probability that they will be interested enough when you do present your call to action. Damaging admission. When Kelsey and I moved from New York City to the mountains of northern Colorado, our new landlords, Ben and Betty, made sure to notify us of two very important facts about our new home. Number one, rock slides were a very real possibility. And number two, black bears and mountain lions roamed nearby. These facts didn't prevent us from leasing the apartment, but we were glad to know them in advance, and it increased our estimation of their integrity. We weighed the risks, increased our renter's insurance, purchased a can of counter-assault bear pepper spray, and signed the lease. Counterintuitively, making a damaging admission like this to your prospects can actually increase their trust in your ability to deliver what you promise. Since Kelsey and I didn't own a car when we lived in Manhattan, we had to purchase one when we moved to Colorado. We found a car we were interested in purchasing on eBay Motors, but it was uncomfortable to make such a big purchase without actually seeing the vehicle. To help alleviate our concerns, the dealership that listed the car, Masters Auto Collection in Denver, went out of their way to photograph every detail, including a small chip in the paint on the left side, which wasn't a big deal. Because they were willing to include even the small flaws in their description before we purchased, we felt more confident that they had thoroughly described the vehicle. We purchased it, and everything was exactly as described. Without making a damaging admission, Masters Auto Collection wouldn't have made the sale. Your prospects know you're not perfect, so don't pretend to be. People actually get suspicious when something appears to be too good to be true. If an offer appears abnormally good, your prospects will start asking themselves, what's the catch? Instead of making them wonder, tell them yourself. By being upfront with your prospects regarding drawbacks and trade-offs, you'll enhance your trustworthiness and close more sales. Barriers to purchase. Assume for a moment you present an offer to a prospect, and their reply is something along the lines of, no, that doesn't work for me. Time to pack it in and move on? There's always a reason a prospect says no. The fact that they're even talking with you implies that there's at least some interest. Otherwise, the conversation would simply end. There's still hope of closing the sale if you start asking the right questions. Selling anything is largely the process of identifying and eliminating barriers to purchase, risks, unknowns, and concerns that prevent your prospects from buying what you offer. Your primary job as a salesperson is to identify and eliminate barriers standing in the way of completing the transaction. Eliminate your prospects' objections and barriers, and you'll close the deal. There are five standard objections that appear in sales of all kinds. Number one, it costs too much. Loss aversion, which we'll discuss later, makes spending money feel like a loss. By purchasing, the prospect is giving something up, and that naturally makes people hesitate. Some people even experience this sense of loss after they make a purchase decision, a condition called buyer's remorse. Number two, it won't work. If the prospect thinks that there's a chance the offer won't or can't provide the promised benefits, they won't purchase. Number three, it won't work for me. The prospect may believe that the offer is capable of providing benefits to other people, but that they're different, a special case. Number four, I can wait. The prospect may believe they don't have a problem worth addressing right now, even if it's very clear to you that they do. And number five, it's too difficult. If the offer takes any effort whatsoever on their part, the prospect may believe that their contribution will be too hard to manage. To overcome these objections as quickly as possible, it makes sense to build them into the structure of your initial offer. Since these objections are very common, anything that you can do to alleviate them before the prospect considers the offer will make the sales process much easier. Objection number one, it costs too much, is best addressed via framing and value-based selling. If you're selling a piece of software to a business that can save them $10 million a year, and you're asking $1 million a year for a license, your software isn't expensive. It's effectively free. If it's clear that the value of your offer far exceeds the asking price, this objection is moot. Objections two and three, it won't work and it won't work for me, are best addressed via social proof, showing the prospect how customers just like them are already benefiting from your offer. The more like your prospect your stories and testimonials are, the better. That's why referrals are such a powerful sales tool. Customers tend to refer people who have similar situations and needs, and the referral itself helps break down these objections. Objections 4 and 5, I can wait and it's too difficult, are best addressed via education-based selling. Often, your prospects haven't fully realized they have a problem, particularly in the case of absence blindness, which we'll discuss later. If the business doesn't realize it's losing $10 million in the first place, it's difficult to convince them that you can help. The best way to get around this is to focus your early sales efforts on making your customers smarter by teaching them what you know about their business, then helping them visualize what their involvement would look like if they decide to proceed. Once you have the prospect's attention and permission, there are two possible tactics if they still have these objections. Number one, convince the prospect that the objection isn't true. Or number two, convince the prospect that the objection is irrelevant. The approach you'll use depends on the objection raised, but some combination of framing, value-based selling, education-based selling, social proof, and visualization will usually do the trick. If the prospect still doesn't buy, that typically means there's a power issue. Your negotiating partner may not have the budget or the authority to agree to your proposal. Always try to negotiate directly with the decision maker. That way, if they refuse your offer, you know that it's because it wasn't a good fit for them, and you can move on to more promising prospects as quickly as possible. Risk reversal. People always hate to lose. They hate to feel stupid. They hate to make bad decisions or waste money. They hate to take risks. When it comes to closing sales, you are that risk. In every transaction, the purchaser is taking on some risk. What if this doesn't work as promised? What if it doesn't meet their needs? What if purchasing from you is a waste of money? These questions are always in the back of your prospect's mind as they're considering purchasing from you. If you don't eliminate these questions, it's very likely they'll ruin the sale. Risk reversal is a strategy that transfers some or all of the risk of a transaction from the buyer to the seller. Instead of making the purchaser shoulder the risk of a bad transaction, the seller agrees in advance to make things right if, for whatever reason, things don't turn out as the purchaser expected. Take the betting industry, for example. Look around and you'll see a lot of over-the-top offers. 12-month, 100% money-back guarantees, no questions asked. A customer could sleep on a bed for a year, decide they didn't like it, and call up the store to return it for a full refund. Crazy, right? It's not crazy at all. This strategy completely eliminates the purchaser's perception of risk, which is a major barrier to purchase. If a customer makes a purchase and it doesn't work out, they don't have to feel stupid about wasting their money, and they don't have to feel angry at the company or at themselves for making a bad decision. All they need to do is take advantage of the guarantee and return it. No big deal. As a result, they'll go through with the transaction. There's no downside, so why not? Colloquially, this approach is sometimes called the take the puppy home strategy. If you visit a pet store and meet an adorable puppy, but you're not sure whether or not you're ready to commit, the pet store will tell you to take the puppy home on a trial basis. If it doesn't work, the salesman says, you can always bring it back. The puppy almost never comes back, of course. Without making this promise, though, the puppy might never go home in the first place. Adopting a risk reversal strategy is naturally uncomfortable because sellers also hate to lose. No seller wants to feel used or taken advantage of, and it's often easy to feel that way if a customer obviously gets value from the offer and asks for a refund anyway. The difference is that the purchaser is purchasing from one seller. The seller is selling to many purchasers. Your customers experience this risk with every purchase they make, and it's a big deal. Since you're serving many customers, you can spread the risk of a return among many customers. Yes, you'll lose money on customers who are obviously taking advantage of your generosity, and that never feels good. In compensation, by eliminating the risk that every purchaser feels, you'll close many more sales and come out way ahead in terms of total revenue and profit. If you want to maximize your sales, it almost always makes sense to offer a very strong risk-reversing guarantee and to extend the risk-free period as much as possible. If you don't already have a risk reversal policy, implement one, and your sales will increase. Reactivation. Sales is the process of convincing prospects to become customers. Winning new customers, however, is often costly and time-intensive. What if there was another way to bring in more revenue at very little additional cost? Reactivation is the process of convincing past customers to buy from you again. If you've been in business for a while, you'll inevitably have some lapsed customers, people who have already purchased from you but haven't purchased in quite some time. You know they're interested in what you have to offer, and you probably already have their contact information. Why not present them with a new offer to make them active customers once again? Netflix is a company that uses reactivation brilliantly. If you cancel a Netflix subscription, 3 to 6 months later, you'll receive a postcard and/or an email from Netflix with an offer to resubscribe at a reduced rate. If you don't reply, they'll send another message every few months until you resubscribe or request to be removed completely from their system. Since Netflix is a subscription business, every reactivated customer means a new monthly stream of income, which greatly enhances the lifetime value of each customer. Reactivation is typically a quicker, simpler, and more effective approach to increasing revenue than attracting new customers. Your old customers already know and trust you, and they're aware of the value you provide. You have their information. You don't have to find them. Your cost of customer acquisition, a component of allowable acquisition cost, which we'll discuss later, is extremely low. All you have to do is contact them and present an attractive offer. Reactivation is much simpler if you have permission from your customers to follow up. Your list of prospective customers is a valuable asset, but your list of past customers is just as valuable. By obtaining permission from your customers to follow up with them, you increase the probability of reactivation if they, for whatever reason, stop buying from you. Most point-of-sale systems keep track of customer data, who purchased, and when the sale was made. It's relatively simple to extract a list of customers who haven't purchased from you in a while, then present them with a reactivation offer directly via email, phone call, or postal mail. Reactivation campaigns are consistently the easiest and most profitable marketing activities you'll ever try. Make it a priority every 3 to 6 months to contact your lapsed customers with another offer to see if you can encourage them to start buying again, and you'll be amazed by the results.